it's not right that a central body just decides what is and isn't issues for tenants and landlords and agents. And it is something that we should all work together.
Welcome to another edition of Eye on the Peninsula, Tuesday the 19th of July, with discussions that look at discrimination around rental properties and bond issues in Frankston. More on that later in the program. Good afternoon, I'm Piers Cunningham, broadcasting from the RPPFM studios in Mornington. Today we talk about Port Phillip Bay and the record numbers of validated whale sightings. It was 3 years ago, last Tuesday, since Hastings jeweller Dermot O'Toole was killed at the hands of a man affected by ice. We speak with Dermot's sons at a candlelight vigil. We hear from a local animal activist about greyhound racing on the peninsula. The Honourable Greg Hunt, member for Flinders, will move from the Environment Portfolio to become the Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science, where he will drive the National Innovation and Science Agenda. More on that later. But first, New South Wales Premier Mike Baird recently announced the banning of greyhound racing by July 2017. The report given by the Herald Sun last week said that many inquiries uncovered not only live baiting of rabbits, piglets and possums, but some 70,000 dogs had been mass slaughtered over a 12-year period, some drowned. Other significant findings included continuous doping with the use of erythropoietin, commonly known as EPO, steroids, caffeine and amphetamines. The report also claims that at least 140 dogs a year suffered mistreatment, catastrophic injuries during races, resulting in death. I've shone a light on an industry that has overseen the slaughter of tens of thousands of healthy dogs whose only crime was that they weren't fast enough, Mr. Baird said. Deborah Maher speaks with Luke Holmesby from Strategic Communications and Marketing at Victorian Greyhound Racing. Her first line of inquiry includes if animal rights activist groups or other groups are putting pressure on Victorian Greyhound Racing, and will the Andrews government follow the decision made by the New South Wales government?
There's been a bit of feedback, for sure. I believe the state government has received some feedback as well. We're constantly in dialogue with the animal rights activists, and that has definitely been the case over the past week.
Does the Victorian Greyhound Racing have a clean nose when it comes to, say, live baiting?
Well, we don't shy away from the story that emerged in the Four Corners report in February last year. In the 16 months since then, we've gone out of our way to radically overhaul everything about greyhound racing in our state. We've more than doubled our integrity budget. We've quadrupled our animal welfare inspectors, tripled our drug swabbing. And we won't defend or tolerate anyone who we know to be taking part in animal cruelty. And there is absolutely no place for any of that in the new greyhound racing Victoria.
Mr. Holmesby was asked about the repercussions to the greyhound industry if it was banned in Victoria.
Oh, look, that's a bit of a hypothetical. We've received support from the Victorian government immediately following the announcement by New South Wales last week. Our racing minister, Mark McCaw, has expressed on the public record support for us, reminding everyone that there are standards that we are expected to uphold. It's a work in progress, but we are heading in the right direction. So we haven't been given any indication that Victoria will be following suit. So we're carrying on as we have been in pursuing our reform agenda.
Now, with the banning of greyhound racing in New South Wales, what's it going to do with the industry down in Victoria? Do you find that a lot of greyhound trainers and owners will be coming to Victoria now?
Yeah, well, look, there could be a flow-on effect, and that's something that people within our building are discussing at the moment about what the possible implications could be from the closure of New South Wales. Whether that's our responsibility, I did note that the statement from Premier Baird last week did make mention of the fact that the government would be working with the greyhound authorities in New South Wales to transition the dogs and the people involved in the industry out of the industry. And that plan is set to roll out in the coming months. So we'll be watching with keen interest to see what that plan is and how the people and the dogs in New South Wales can be looked after by the state government of New South Wales.
With pressure mounting for the greyhound industry in Victoria to close down, should you be looking at reform rather than banning?
Look, the reform is well advanced in Victoria. You know, this sport really should have the opportunity to prove it can fundamentally change. It delivers economic and community benefits. You know, there's 3,000 people involved in greyhound racing in Victoria who rely on the industry for employment, many of them in regional and rural parts of the state where employment isn't as easy to come by. And there's other economic benefits to the state as well. So, but animal welfare is, by and large, the number one priority. And there are very advanced reforms taking place. They will continue to advance. And by no means we believe that we've ticked every box and everything is perfectly on track. We are heavily invested in reforming greyhound racing in Victoria. So, and we've been given every indication from the authorities that they have faith in us to continue those reforms and continue along that path.
What recommendations are you following to keep the integrity of the greyhound racing industry intact?
Yeah, well, look, there's been a few recommendations along the way. The McHugh inquiry obviously referred specifically to New South Wales, but we've had recommendations from the Chief Veterinary Office and the Office of Racing Integrity, as well as the BITAR report, which covered integrity measures in all three racing codes in Victoria. So we've taken on the recommendations that have come from those reports. We've been heavily scrutinised in those reports. We welcome those reports. The 68 recommendations from the Chief Veterinary Officer and from the Racing Integrity Officer, we are going about implementing those recommendations. You know, these reviews are landmark reviews, and they provide some really important framework and roadmap to guide these changes. So the Victorian Government has accepted those recommendations and have made it clear to us, and we agree that animal welfare is a non-negotiable priority and will continue to be so.
We'll take a short break and be back with the other side of the debate with the former Flinders candidate for the Animal Justice Party and animal activist Ben Wild. Greyhound owners and trainers are happy to take the moral high ground when it comes to defending the greyhound racing industry. But reliable reports have surfaced detailing the horrific findings and cruel practices inflicted on baited animals and greyhounds in the bloody industry. It appears their only crime was they weren't fast enough, says New South Wales Premier Mike Baird, who banned greyhound racing in New South Wales a couple of weeks ago. This has called for other states in Australia to take action. Ben Wild, animal activist and candidate who ran in the seat of Flinders for the Animal Justice Party in the last election, was asked if he'd heard of any cruelty to greyhounds and animals in the local area, including in and around the Cranbourne Greyhound Racing Track.
It's very hard to get people to come forward, for one, trainers. They definitely don't want to come in and actually talk to us directly about what's actually going on the actual property.
Does that mean that there could be something going on?
Look, I'm not saying that there is, and I'm not saying that there isn't. I mean, the reality is the reports that have come out from a federal and a national perspective is showing cruelty across the board. And I guess when you look at the actual practices involved, where the trainers themselves actually freely admit to the fact that, you know, there is a significant wastage in this industry, and that's all part and parcel of what happens. And then you've got to look at the fact that 15 Victorians were actually charged with live baiting, and that was primarily at the Turidan track. So,
how long ago was that?
That was all coming out of the Four Corners Animals Australia and Animal Live Queensland expose. So that was only in the last year. So I think there was, across the country, there was, I think, 5 in New South Wales, I think 15 here and 37 up in Queensland that were all charged as part of that investigation.
There appears to be some hypocrisy with trainers in the industry. On one hand, they are saying how much they love their dogs, and on the other hand, they are saying we kill them if they don't perform. Another aspect that isn't spoken about much in the equation is the cost, not only to the lives of many poorly treated animals, but the people who are caught up in gambling, affecting the fabric of our society. Ben has this to add.
I don't deny that they probably love their dogs, but I think they love them as much as you said, they perform for them. They're basically commodities. So the numbers that come out are saying that, you know, up to 18,000 dogs are killed each year across the country. Now, if that is saying 8,000 of them are puppies and 10,000 of those are the retirees, the reality is, I think it's 9 out of 10 dogs literally won't make it past 5 years of age. So once they've even actually performed and done all the duties as a athlete, I guess if that's what they're going to call it for them, they then either have to try to get them rehomed, which is proven not to work through the GAP program, or they get euthanized.
Do you think it's time now we look at it as a hobby rather than an industry?
I just don't think they can actually go back to it being a hobby. I mean, there's such big money involved now, and we've got to think it's not just the cruelty to animals that are happening in this industry. You know, over $4 billion is actually gambled on greyhound racing each year. And the latest stats are saying that it's actually the millennials and the Gen Ys who are actually the more addicted to the gambling via their smartphones, and especially the biggest greyhound gamblers. So I think about what's happening to socially to the population as well, and how much damage that the gambling problem's doing, not just only on the dog. So I find it, as you said, it's so hypocritical that they can sit there and say, oh, but, you know, poor us, poor us. But, well, what are you actually doing to generate that income? You're putting so many animals through torture and then murdering them, and then obviously you're also destroying the fabric of society. I mean, there's no good here.
Local and state governments have to put pressure on the greyhound industry to clean it up. What pressure will you place on the Victorian government, and should the industry be banned?
Fundamentally, the whole industry has to be banned nationwide. I think Mike Baird is incredibly brave, and you've got to give kudos to what he's actually trying to achieve here. And let's be clear, he hasn't actually managed to get it through Parliament. That's got to be introduced as a bill. And the New South Wales Labor have come out basically saying that they don't support it, and they're trying to swing, you know, 11 Nationals onto their side to actually ban the legislation. So there's still a fight there, and I think that's fundamentally where we're stuck at the moment, is putting pressure onto the New South Wales Labor to say, well, no, if you actually disallow this, you're going to have some serious trouble at the next election in New South Wales. But secondly, Daniel Andrews has come out saying that there's no need for it to be banned in this state due to the fact that the industry is reforming, and I challenge that because we haven't seen any reform. I mean, ultimately, we're going to start hearing of more horror stories, no doubt, in the near future. I mean, to me, it screams of a live export debacle where, you know, people forget about it for a few years, and then all of a sudden another expose comes out and say, oh, that's right, didn't we ban that? And then they sort of, you know, get back on it again. But from my perspective of what we can do is there's a few things that we need to do from an animal welfare law perspective, and we need to give some more power to the councils to actually go out and actually check these facilities. But also I think the fundamental one for us is that we're going to take on, as a political party, because we know that votes are the only way to actually get real action in society, unfortunately, and we're going to take on any government that actually says that they'll support this industry, and we will do whatever it takes as a party to run in all those seats and actually put pressure on with votes. So our area down in Flinders, so if you think of Heen and Bass, if we can get a little swing and maintain our 4 or 5% of the vote, then we could actually change who's holding that seat. That's what we're going to be doing over the next few years.
The RSPCA needs to be given more power.
Across the country, I think there's something like 60,000 complaints of cruelty, yet only about 250 of them actually get successfully prosecuted. So that's about, I don't know, 0.5% conviction rate. So there's a real problem there. And ultimately what's going on is that the laws that they're governed by, this is the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals Act, is basically toothless. It's got no bite whatsoever. There's actually some council bylaws that actually allow anything to really happen. So there's two fundamental things that need to change straight away, and that is we need to make sure that all our councils actually have strong bylaws in regards to animal cruelty. That's as simple as things as saying, you know, maximum amount of dogs or animals per property, you know, not being able to tether animals 24 hours a day. But the basics, which you think would be fundamentally written to law, which they're not. And then secondly, we need those councils, we need all their rangers to actually be empowered under the POFTA Act. So right now I think there's about 15 sectors in Victoria for RSPCA. So they've got to get across the entire state and cover anywhere up to 15,000 calls of cruelty each year. So if we could actually put all the rangers empowered under that, we'd actually put somewhere like 700 employees that are empowered under POFTA across the state. And that would make a fundamental difference for us to be able to record and actually catch the people while they're doing it. So there's two major changes that need to happen. But ultimately, the big one is we need an independent office of animal welfare, one that doesn't rely on donations from the public, and one that doesn't, that is fully funded and sits independent of government. So that's what we're sort of pushing for in order to fix those problems.
Ben has this final point to make.
Any of the listeners have dealt with council before and putting through complaints that it is a bit of a tedious process, and also with the RSPCA, it's the same thing. You sort of get the generic response, and if it's not noteworthy enough, then the RSPCA are generally not going to do anything about it. There are a lot of greyhound rescue organisations and greyhound groups out there that are raising awareness, and I recommend if you're not following any on Facebook now or on their, you know, website, get on board and have a look at that. I mean, as a representative for the animals of the area now, and I think a lot of people have seen that there's actually now a voice that can actually help. I'm more than happy through my Facebook page or through my AJP Vic email address that people can get in contact with me, and I'll do everything I can to make sure that we highlight the inherent issues that are here.
If this legislation does go through New South Wales, all the greyhound adoption centres will be just overwhelmed, won't they?
Yeah, well, look, let's be clear. One of the key arguments that trainers are putting forward is saying, well, Mike Baird's just signed a death certificate for all these dogs. Well, the reality is, being bred into the greyhound industry is already being signed a death certificate. So as I said earlier, 9 out of 10 of these dogs don't make it past 5 years old. So the GAP program rehome about 1% of the dogs each year. So this is the body that's being funded by the industry to help rehome dogs. That's 1% of the dogs. And the other 9% is done from the charitable organisations, the greyhound rehoming organisations that actually go out there and try to actively push these dogs to save their lives. Yes, there's going to be a mass problem. If we put the right amount of funding into it, and if these guys truly love their dogs, how many should they be keeping? Secondly, if we stop the breeding in New South Wales, there won't be as many dogs to worry about next year. And I think you'll see a massive call to arms from the community in order to help these dogs, because ultimately, you look at all the surveys and all the petitions, it's basically saying people don't want this sport and they're willing to do anything it takes. There's a massive issue here.
Ben is putting it out there to encourage everyone to act and report any cruelty to greyhounds and animals in the wake of the damning reports about the behaviour of greyhound breeders, owners and trainers. If you have any concerns about what you hear or see, email Ben on ben.wild@ajpvic.org.au or contact the Mornington Peninsula Shire and the RSPCA. Ben's details are also on the Eye on the Peninsula Facebook page. This is a wake-up call not only for the greyhound industry Australia-wide, but to other sports involving cruel practices to animals in exchange for money and greed. The message is clear. Clean up your act, Australia.
May it be an evening star shines down upon you. May it be darkness falls, your heart will be true.
Heavenly music rang out by Irish singer Enya as a close community came together to remember Hastings jeweller Dermot O'Toole, who was murdered in his shop 3 years ago. On a cold, bleak night last Tuesday, a compassionate crowd gathered in O'Toole Walk, a laneway in Hastings dedicated to the memory of Dermot. Dermot's wife Bridget and her sons addressed the people to thank them for their support and comfort. Ice addict and convicted murderer Gavin Perry, who was high on the drug at the time he killed Dermot O'Toole on the 12th of July 2013, was on parole for 200 other offences. Bridget was also stabbed during the botched robbery. Perry was sentenced to 27 years jail with an on-parole period of 23 years. A couple of weeks ago, the Court of Appeal ruled out a longer sentence for Perry, saying the sentence of 20 years for statutory murder was 3 years higher than any other sentence previously imposed. It was another blow to the O'Toole family, who wanted Perry prosecuted under common law murder and attempted murder. Instead, he cut a deal to plead guilty to statutory murder, which attracts a lower sentence. Perry is expected to be released in his 50s, hardly a life sentence for his unthinkable crime. Dermot leaves a family who is shattered by the latest decision. Lisa Dixon spoke at the candlelight vigil on behalf of Councillor David Garnock, saying,
he wanted to say thank you to the many shopkeepers who have displayed their windows green for the occasion. And he also wanted to say thank you to the members of the Hastings community who have continued to support and very much hold dear Bridget and the family.
Bridget O'Toole spoke with a heavy heart to thank those who'd supported her and her family.
Thank you, everybody, for coming on here. Just 3 years, it's just been amazing, your support. I know you've all been hurting too. We used to love you coming into the shop, and we all know the laughs we had. We had some great laughs, you know. I don't know what to say. It doesn't get any easier for me, but when see all you people here, it just boosts my morale so much, and I really appreciate it. I don't know what to say other than thank you so much.
Deborah spoke to sons Trent and Christian about their dad and how it makes them feel when the community comes together and remembers him with tributes such as this.
I think it shows us how much it's not just affected our family, it's affected the whole community. and it really has brought the community to get together, and the support they're showing the family has been unbelievably appreciated.
Yeah. And what about you too?
Well, I agree with Trent, but I tend to think too that, you know, as not only have we all been affected by it, but, you know, in a way that we're all kind of one people in a sense, and that this community has been there for Mum and Dad since they opened the shop, and, you know, is still there for us even after we've had to close the shop once Dad had been killed. So it's just a lovely thing to know that we've got support, and it's been a very difficult process through the courts and everything, but to know that we've got a community by our side is a lovely thing. But there are people who have been affected by it too, and I would like them to know that they're in our hearts as well, as much as, you know, we know that we're in theirs.
So Dad's looking down. What do you think he would think about all this? All the fuss. Oh, did he like fuss?
No, he didn't. He was always sort of the centre of attention whenever he came into the room, and he never sought it. He was always just the type of person who liked to laugh, but he was never one to deliberately seek attention. I think that he would find this, I think he'd find this quite amusing, really. Yes.
I was just going to say, I think the weather that he seems to present us with at each one of these memorials is his way of having a laugh at us all.
That's the Irish way, isn't
it? It is.
And just quickly, too, who other people would you like to thank?
Oh, I'd like to thank particular Lisa Dixon, the Chamber of Commerce, the council here. They've just been phenomenal. They're the ones who actually approached us on this. We've had absolutely no input, in the sense that, you know, they've run things past us, but we've never sought this. They approached us about the day, and it's just an amazing thing for the council and the chamber to come together and to do this for us. It's a lovely thing.
Yeah, I'd say probably the biggest person to thank would be David Garnock, the local councillor. He's gone above and beyond organising this, and unfortunately he can't be here today due to personal circumstances. But I just want to say a huge thank to him and everyone who's contributed to this laneway and providing things today. It's been really great.
When you're in Hastings, take a stroll down O'Toole Walk and pause for a moment in front of the statue of a leprechaun to remember a family man who loved his community. Bond issues are Australia's number one problem for renters, according to website Don't Rent Me. When it comes to either raising bond money to rent a property or waiting for the return of bond money, it's been reported that there isn't much protection for tenants. Founder of Don't Rent Me, Mr. Anthony Zeeble, set up the website to encourage tenants to name and shame landlords and real estate agents who don't do the right thing. He compares Frankston with other regions in Australia on bond-related issues. Is it because of the low socioeconomic and disadvantaged people in areas like Frankston that this discrimination is happening?
What we can see for Frankston is we actually have about an 80% of issues that are reported do relate to claims against tenants' bonds. An unfair request that a tenant pays for something to be repaired or improved during their tenancy, which would translate to a bond claim if they refuse to do that.
So why is Frankston then one of the cities on the list?
What we find, and this is actually a national finding, not necessarily just Frankston, is that we have quite a strong representation of women reporting issues. We think that's because women often deal with the move and household issues, and also feel that it's not fair to have these sorts of claims, you know, wrongs that are done to their family. I think it's not right when any tenant is mistreated.
So what rights do tenants have then when it comes to getting their bond money back so that they can move into their next place and use the refunded bond money for their new bond?
Tenants have a right to the return of their bond, but where they're disadvantaged is that a lot of tenants don't realise what they need to do in order to secure their bond return. And quite simply, it all comes down to documentation.
Simple as that?
Well, it can be as simple as that. I mean, it's just something a lot of tenants do forget about, because when you're moving a house, preparing to move a house, there's a lot involved in that. And certainly taking photos, documenting, photocopying, condition reports, things like that are really something that just escapes a lot of people's minds. We find a lot of tenants say that the agent, for example, in the exit inspection said that everything was great. That was simply because the tenant didn't take photos, they didn't take a copy of the condition report, saying if you don't have anything documented, there's really nothing that the department can do to actually side with you there.
Are they not getting their bond back, though, because they may have trashed the place or a landlord's being difficult? There has to be a reason.
Look, I guess our perspective is that we go off the word of people who do leave reviews on our site, and we're obviously a tenant advocate as well. We take the word of the tenant seriously. According to our users, these are unfair claims on their bonds, so ones where they think that the landlord's being too picky or, for example, they're taking a case of fair wear and tear and saying, well, no, it's not, and I want you to replace it. And if you don't have anything documented, there's really nothing that the department can do to actually side with you there.
Shouldn't it be the law that the condition report be given to the tenant by the real estate agent?
Quite simply, a lot of real estate agencies don't do that, and they're not necessarily required to give you a copy of it. You do need to ask for one. And you can also complete your own condition report and date it at the time and send that to the real estate agent as well. So a lot of tenants think they have to live by the will and good graces of their agents or landlords, but in fact, they do have rights. They just need to know how to enforce them.
Is it better to deal directly with a landlord rather than a real estate agent?
If you are a tenant who is going to have a direct relationship with a landlord and there is no agent in the middle, you should be a tenant who clearly understands their rights and how to protect them, because a landlord may not understand what is required of them. And that is supposed to be the job of an agent, is to instruct them. So it will come down to the tenant to make sure that you are protected and make sure that things like your bond are correctly lodged and that some sort of tenancy agreement has been signed, that the term is properly defined, that entry and exit reports are actually completed. There are definitely benefits to using an agent. I think that there's certainly a place for honest and reputable real estate agencies, but unfortunately we see time and time again that they're more vested in protecting the landlord than the tenant, and so it really does come down to a tenant protecting themselves, and tenants deserve representation.
What organisation can tenants rely on to help with bond issues?
Some states don't even have tribunals or a consumer protection
Victoria?
Division. Victoria, there is a residential tribunal, but there are some states that don't even have that. So if you have a problem with your landlord, you actually have to take them to court, which is, again, it really is disgraceful. And in some states, they don't even have a bond board. So the bond is literally just held with the landlord, even if there is an agency involved. Mm. That's what we're invested in doing, is making sure that people are aware of what they're getting involved with.
Anthony advises what to do if you're experiencing issues with your bond.
For those who are experiencing trouble with their bond, and they don't qualify for any help from social welfare departments if they offer that sort of help in your state, and we do offer a service through myrentalbond.com, and we've partnered with a licensed financial provider who can look at trying to help you with finance or a shortfall or deficit in your bond or the whole bond.
Anthony is starting up a party in the upper house in the next federal election to stand up for people who are discriminated against for their race, colour or lifestyle choices when trying to rent.
Off the back of the success of the Don't Rent Me website, we're actually launched a political party for tenant rights. We're covering three areas, which is basically a national tenancy body. So we just want to look at reforming the law nationally. We also have a piece on anti-discrimination. So some landlords and agents ask some interesting questions on tenancy applications, which are clearly designed to discriminate against someone based on their lifestyle choices rather than their suitability for renting. We've done an analysis on that, and we can see, at least for now, the three main trends, and we want to correct that nationally. And we're also going to look at housing affordability. Don't Rent Me is a great website for exposing problems that people have as a renter, but we're not able to do a lot with that in terms of lobbying government, and we certainly get no support from the real estate industry. So we want to take it a step further and actually look at getting involved in politics and actually standing up for all tenants of Australia, a fair rental marketplace. And that's something that tenants don't really have at the moment, is a strong representation in government. It's a bit of a David and Goliath battle where we're going up against some pretty big industries and a lot of vested interests. It is a people power movement. We want to create a national act. Should be brought up by way of public forum. It's not right that a central body just decides what is and isn't issues for tenants and landlords and agents. And it is something that we should all work together. I think it is sorely needed, and that's something that I am invested in achieving.
Anthony's using the Don't Rent Me website to gain insight into trends and what tenants are really facing when renting. So if you're dissatisfied when applying for rental properties or trying to get your bond money back, visit don'trentme.com.au. If you're interested in the work Anthony's doing in the political platform, visit his tenant rights political party website, tenantrights.org.au. There is a strong message: be diligent and make sure you know your rights. Before you hand over your bond money, document everything about the property before you sign on the dotted line. Thank you to Deborah Ma for that report. Field Research Officer at the Dolphin Research Institute is excited about what we see today, as we see a record number of whale sightings both in Western Port Bay and Port Phillip Bay. David Donnelly is noting movements of humpbacks, southern rights and killer whales. Deborah Ma curiously asked why this is the case.
This morning's sightings were first reported as being two killer whales, so we believe that they are in fact southern right whales.
And do you know how many were in the pod?
We know that it was at least one, and it could have been two, but the thing with southern rights is they're quite snaky animals. They can make themselves look bigger or more than they are. Quite often people mistake one for being two, or they can be easily mistaken as killer whales because the way they put their fluke tips out of the water looks very much like a dorsal. We probably get three or four mis-IDs every winter.
Great.
We need to clarify. It's very important that we validate all that sight.
David is happy to report that numbers of validated sightings in Port Phillip Bay alone this season is 56, up from 33 last year. These numbers are mainly made up of humpback whales. Why the larger numbers?
One is the weather, obviously. It could be better, therefore the sightings might be better. Also, we have more people looking, and we also have a growing population of East Coast Australian humpback whales.
Do whales calf here?
The southern right whales will be calving, but most probably they'll be calving to the west. There's no known calving area in our current survey area, being the Port Phillip region and Western Port region. Not to say that they wouldn't calve here, but we would be expecting them to be calving into the west towards Logan Beach and Warrnambool, Port Ferry, those areas.
Has the recent ban of commercial fishing in the bay encouraged whales to enter because of the increased fish stock?
Yeah, I don't think commercial fisheries have really anything to do with the sighting rate, whether they're low or high. These animals are on migration and they're fasting during this period. Targeting fish species for prey is something we would be, it's not unheard of, but it's unlikely. Having said that, the killer whales may target some species of fish, such as medium-sized sharks and possibly snapper and kingfish. But I don't think that the commercial fishing ban in either of the bays will have had an impact on the migration of the larger whales.
What about the clarity and the cleanliness of the water? Could that be a reason why whales visit us?
The clarity or the condition of the water will have little effect on large migrating whales. They're going from A to B and they'll take the same path or close to the similar path that they do each year when they migrate. If animals are coming past Port Phillip or Western Port or even entering either of those two bays, I don't think that there'll be any influence by the condition of the water, whether the water quality is good or poor. They're just passing by on migration to the north. Some of the younger animals, such as the sub-adults, so we're talking anything from yearling age, being 12 months, of course, through to around about the 4 or 5 year animals, they seem to be less enthused about getting north, and they do get distracted. They like to take a look at their surrounds. They may even interact with vessels at times. We often find the sub-adults are the ones that are coming into the bays just exploring. Not to say we don't get adults, we do, but I think that they're either just having a look or perhaps made a wrong turn.
Are whale numbers healthy after the southern right whales were hunted almost to extinction in the late 1970s?
Currently, the humpback whales of the east coast of Australia are predicted to reach around 26,000 animals. Now, these animals mix with the South Pacific animals as well, so there's still a bit of work to be done in separating those two or three or four populations. So you'd have to say that the humpback whales of eastern Australia are doing very, very well with an annual increase in population size of around 10%. The southern right whales are a completely different story. They were hunted almost to extinction along the Victorian coast, and in fact the southeast region of Australia, because of their nature of just hanging close to the coast. They've been very slow, they were easy to hunt, and they yielded quite a lot of oil. It's believed that they were almost down to non-recoverable numbers, but they've since come back a little bit, about 224 to 251 individuals in the southeast region of Australia.
David also has an important job researching dolphins.
My job revolves around, when we're talking about the field work, and we're often doing surveys in Port Phillip, Western Port, nearby Bass Strait, Phillip Island, and the Gippsland Lakes region. We have a strong focus on the common dolphins around the Mornington area, and we also investigate the Southern Australian bottlenose dolphin. We have a long-term study, which is 25 years old now. So that's my main role in that capacity, as well as documenting passing whales as they come and go through our bay.
And they're all healthy too? We don't have to worry about them?
I think it's being vigilant and looking after what we have, and that begins right at our litter trap up the rivers. Very important that we keep an eye on these animals throughout the year. But if you're asking the question, are they in trouble right now? Well, it seems that based on the 25-year history of the Dolphin Research Institute, there's been little change in the population size. So you'd have to say it's stable. Whether it's super healthy, well, we're working on that too, where we've got a dolphin health project up and running at the moment, which is relatively in its infancy at the moment, but we hope to develop that a bit further and get a bit of a more of a handle of what the health is of the bay populations itself.
Member for Flinders and former Environment Minister Greg Hunt put $2 million aside for the development of a marine research centre at the Point Nepean Quarantine Station, operated by Melbourne University. Will you work alongside researchers at the centre?
We'd like to think that we would play a role in such a facility. We do have quite a lot to offer in the context of general knowledge of the bays and obviously the dolphins, marine mammals of our bays. So it would be nice to be involved, but these things always take a bit of time and collaboration and work to build relationships. So we'll certainly be on the table and willing to help where we can. So I look forward to that opportunity.
Whales in this region migrate between May and July, and we also get returning pods in the October, November, December period. David encourages us to log whale sighting at the DRI website, dolphinresearch.org.au. So look out for these majestic animals when you're next peering across the waters. The Honourable Greg Hunt, Member for Flinders, has been appointed as Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science. In a statement put out by the Minister's office yesterday, he said he's delighted to be appointed to the role. Science and innovation, he said, are deep personal interests and flow directly from my work with the environment. It represents Australia's future and are fundamental drivers of growth and employment. He adds, I'm delighted to see my good friend Josh Frydenberg appointed as Minister for the Environment and Energy. He will be outstanding and is passionate about clean air, clean water, clean land, heritage and Antarctica. Eye on the Peninsula has contacted the Minister's office and will report on his policies that he's working on as the new Minister for Industry, Innovation and Science. And finally, when Eye on the Peninsula interviewed Cerberus Ward Councillor David Garnock a couple of weeks ago about his swim to raise funds for MS, he was unsure whether he'd live up to his expectations and complete the swim. Councillor Garnock is pleased to announce that he and Shire Mayor Councillor Graham Pittock, who joined him, helped raise more than $14,000 for the MS 24-hour mega swim at Pelican Park, Hastings. That brings the total raised over the past 5 years to more than $100,000. 75 swimmers swam more than 440 kilometres to raise funds for the MS Society on Saturday the 2nd and Sunday the 3rd of July. Funds raised go to MS Go for Gold scholarships, financial assistance programs, and providing services to directly benefit those living with multiple sclerosis. Well, that concludes our program for another week. If you have any news from the street you want to share with our team, please contact RPPFM on 59751234. Next week, on the Peninsula will again bring you up to date with issues that matter. We hope you can tune in next Tuesday at noon on 98.7 or 98.3 FM, Frankston. You can live stream from our website, rpfm.com.au, and download the RPFM app. If you miss any Eye on the Peninsula programs, podcasts are available on our website, and check out the Eye on the Peninsula Facebook page. Don't forget the Briars Ward Community Meeting coming up on Thursday the 21st of July at the Mornington Shire Council Chambers, starting at 6 p.m. Go to the Mornpen website for details. Thank you to Deborah Maher, Executive Producer of Eye on the Peninsula, guests, and Kevin Wilcox, our news researcher. And if you're interested in presenting your own radio program on RPPFM or reporting for Eye on the Peninsula, contact our station manager, Brendan Telfer, on 5975 1234. I'm Piers Cunningham. Thanks for your company.